Democracy Now! Will be reporting live from COP29 in Baku, Azerbaijan, all next week from November 18th to November 22nd. Tune in to democracynow.org. Happy birthday to Ishmael Darro. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamiri Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, and Hannah Elias. Our executive directors, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prue, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO. In accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Executive Committee meets on the second Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Meetings are held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify that a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Multnomah County will continue to distribute tarps to those in need.
The first permanent year-round shelter for adults in Washington County opens Monday.
And Portland Mayor-elect Keith Wilson pressured Commissioners Mingus Maps, Dan Ryan, and Renee Gonzalez to walk back JOHS severance plans.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 13th, 2024. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. Multnomah County adopts a new policy for distributing tents and tarps to unsheltered homeless residents. Distributing tents and tarps has been a thorny issue for some local politicians. The new policy was put into effect on Tuesday. The county will continue to distribute tarps until there is, quote, sufficient shelter and affordable housing capacity to make the distribution of tents and tarps unnecessary, end quote. At the last point-in-time count in January 2023, there were over 6,000 homeless residents in the county. Shelter capacity and affordable housing availability is still too low to meet the need, about 2,000 shelter beds at county-supported shelters. The policy states, quote, tents and tarps are life-saving supplies, particularly when adequate shelters and housing are unavailable. Tents and tarps mitigate the poor health outcomes associated with unsheltered homelessness and provide a limited level of safety, security, and privacy, end quote. This may be particularly important going into the winter season in Portland, which is expected to be wetter than normal. The policy limits the county to only giving out one tent per person, and it says they'll reassess the policy next April and next December. The cost of tents for the next fiscal year makes up 0.05% of the Homeless Services Office budget.
Washington County will see its first year-round homeless shelter open on Monday, November 18th. The Beaverton Shelter off Highway 217 broke ground last year. It will provide 60 beds with privacy around sleeping areas, 3 meals a day, showers, laundry, and supportive services available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The city of Beaverton owns the building, but the nonprofit Open Door Housing Works will operate it. In May 2020, voters approved Measure 26210 that would allocate funds to services for people experiencing houselessness. The measure works under Metro, the government agency that crosses counties in the greater Portland area. It's helped to fund many housing projects so far, like Hillside Park in Milwaukee that broke ground this year in early October. The measure covered a majority of capital costs for this build and is providing $1.2 million a year to fund ongoing services for the Beaverton Shelter. The shelter opens amidst a slate of anti-homeless initiatives and laws set by Oregon elected officials. In October, 3 Portland City commissioners tried to end an intergovernmental agreement with Multnomah County that funds homeless services. They retracted their termination attempt a day after the election last week.
Portland City Commissioners Dan Ryan, Mingus Maps, and Renee Gonzalez were the ones who drew up an ordinance to dissolve the Joint Office of Homeless Services agreement with Multnomah County a month ago. Last Wednesday, they decided to cancel their filing. Commissioner Dan Ryan said Mayor-elect Keith Wilson, told them to drop it. Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson said the termination attempt was a, quote, election stunt, end quote, because all 3 commissioners were running for either the mayor's seat or city council. Ryan said, quote, Mayor-elect Wilson has made it clear that he would like us to take that off the table. So out of respect for the new mayor, it was just good manners, end quote. Ryan will be serving District 2, which represents North and Northeast Portland in the new 12-member city council. He said he still wants to address the joint office, quote, the intention for all of us to improve the system is there. I think we can all admit the system needs improvement so that the taxpayers who are paying for this can see what is actually being done on the ground, end quote. A Willamette Week poll of all the candidates expected to be elected showed Ryan was the only one out of the 12 that wanted to end the agreement. Current Mayor Ted Wheeler and Commissioner Carmen Rubio objected to the ordinance when the commissioners first proposed it in October. Multnomah County Commissioner Shannon Singleton, who once ran the joint office, said they need to make improvements, but also remember why the services exist in the first place. In a press release, Wilson said, quote, I made clear on many occasions during the campaign that I was not in favor of pulling out of the intergovernmental agreement. I recognize that there are legitimate concerns about the design, goals, and success metrics of the joint office, but pulling out at this point would cost the city precious time and money, end quote.
Portland City Council adopted the Portland Bureau of Transportation's Vision Zero initiative, a goal to eliminate traffic violence back in 2016. But the city auditor released an audit of that program today, saying it's falling short of its goals. Crashes declined in the first 4 years of the initiative, but started rising in 2020. Fatalities hit a high of 64 in 2021 and then reached 69 just last year, more traffic violence than in any time in nearly 40 years. PBOT used the Vision Zero Action Plan to collect data on the most dangerous intersections and streets in the city and then implement safety features. An audit in 2019 made PBOT update the project and divide it into 4 strategies with specific actions: protect pedestrians, reduce speed citywide, design streets to protect human lives, and create a culture of shared responsibility. The audit found that the Bureau partially completed safety projects, but needed better measurements and more data to address the full scope. PBOT's biggest strategy was to add street lighting, change signal timing, and provide crossing in between intersections. The Bureau also gained control to reduce residential speed limits to 20 miles an hour. The audit found that the Bureau did not add as much lighting or crosswalks as anticipated and failed to install as many speed cameras as they said they would. PBOT noted that more than half of the projects were completed on time and cited the pandemic, hiring freezes, and supply chain issues as reasons for falling short. The audit recommends routine, systematic evaluations on projects, especially once completed. It also said the Bureau could do more to focus on equity, like smaller safety projects in low-income areas and communities of color. The audit said, quote, East Portland is home to most of the deadliest streets and intersections in the city, which makes it less safe to walk in that section of the city. Not only are pedestrians in East Portland more than twice as likely to be killed in a traffic crash than those walking in other areas of the city, but the majority of all traffic fatalities also occur east of the Willamette River, end quote.
Oregon State University's Coalition of Graduate Employees, also known as CGE, went on strike on Tuesday. The union represents more than 1,700 graduate teaching and research assistants at the university's main campus in Corvallis. This is the first strike in CGE's 25-year history. The union is seeking a total 40% salary bump for its lowest paid members to keep up with inflation and the rising costs of living in the Corvallis area. Brandy Whiteman, vice president of bargaining for CGE, said, quote, "Our lowest paid workers are struggling, and that is a significant increase to their salaries," end quote. A spokesperson for OSU said that classes will continue as far as possible during the strike. With over 36,000 students this fall, OSU reached record enrollment for the 27th consecutive year.
GOP leaders say they're ready for President-elect Trump to return to office. President Biden hosts the Israeli president amid concerns about blocked Gaza aid. And the labor movement assesses the impact of Trump being back in the White House. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
There's a lot of excitement, a lot of energy here. We're really grateful for President Trump leaving it all on the field to get reelected.
House Speaker Mike Johnson and top House Republicans are back in Washington and say they're eager for President-elect Donald Trump's return. Johnson said they're continuing to watch some undecided House races, but are confident it'll stay under GOP control. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer congratulated Trump on his victory and encouraged Democrats to not look at last week's election results as a defeat, but rather a challenge.
We have to look at what we did right, what we did wrong, and what we didn't do, but should have done.
Congress is facing a busy lame duck session. Government funding is set to expire next month. Republicans will need to decide whether to compromise with Democrats on longer-term spending or force a short-term extension until Trump takes office. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says another priority is the defense bill.
Every year, the NDAA gives Congress an indispensable opportunity to set national security priorities. This year, it's a chance to show we appreciate the gravity of an especially dangerous moment.
Former GOP Congressman and staunch Trump critic Adam Kinzinger is praising Trump's pick for Secretary of State. Kinzinger says Republican Florida Senator Marco Rubio has the knowledge and experience for one of the most important positions in the cabinet.
Compared to some of the other names that were floating around, people that don't have any experience in foreign policy, I think this is a pretty good one.
President Joe Biden met with Israeli President Isaac Herzog in Washington, while aid groups are again sounding alarms about grim conditions in northern Gaza. The White House has asked for more aid to get in, and U.S. law requires countries that get American military support allow humanitarian assistance. But State Department spokesperson Vedant Patel disagrees with those who say Israel is blocking aid.
We at this time have not made an assessment that the Israelis are in violation of U.S. law.
Biden and Trump will meet today at the White House, even though Trump didn't extend the same invitation to Biden in 2020. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says Biden is following a tradition tied to the peaceful transfer of power.
It is important not just because it's important to him, but it's important to the American people. He said the American people deserve this. They deserve a smooth transition.
The labor movement is assessing the moment. Many union voters supported Trump's promise of high tariffs on imports. Others point to his previous cuts in job site safety inspectors and his likelihood of blocking a proposed heat safety rule. Mike Wild with the Fair Contracting Foundation of Minnesota says they'll be watching enforcement, which doesn't have to be a partisan issue.
We can have all the laws we want on the books, but unless they're enforced and meaningful, they don't do anybody any good.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Molly King from QDoc, the only festival in the world devoted exclusively to LGBTQ documentaries. At 6, it's For the Wild. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather is rainy with a low of 51 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will also be rainy, what a surprise, with a high of 52 degrees. Today in history, Robin Hood is banned in Indiana in 1953. Feeding into the Red Scare, the Indiana Textbook Commission said it's a, quote, communist directive in education because he robbed the rich and gave it to the poor. That's the communist line. It's just a smearing of law and order, and anything that disrupts law and order is their meat, end quote. The quote of the day is from Helder Camara, a Brazilian archbishop who advocated for liberation theology during the military dictatorship in Brazil. He said, quote, when I give food to the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why they are poor, they call me a communist, end quote.
As Republicans and Democrats battle it out for control of the U.S. House, Alaska's lone congressional seat appears to be closer to being flipped. People on the Wind River Reservation say President Joe Biden's recent apology for the federal Indian boarding school system needs follow-up, and federal officials announced a new round of funding to help tribes access clean drinking water. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As Republicans and Democrats battle it out for control of the U.S. House, Alaska's lone congressional seat appears to be closer to being flipped. The seat is held by Democrat Mary Peltola, the first Alaska Native to be elected to Congress. KMBA's Rhonda McBride has the latest numbers.
Since election night, Mary Peltola has trailed her Republican challenger, Nick Begich III, by about 10,000 votes. After the Alaska Division of Elections added more than 38,000 votes to the totals late Tuesday night, Peltola cut into her opponent's lead by a few hundred votes, but the gap between the two candidates remains about the same. So far, Begich has 49.1% of the vote, not enough to avoid triggering Alaska's ranked choice voting system on November 20th. If Begich cannot surpass a threshold of 50% of the vote, the second choice votes for the other two candidates in the race will be divided between Begich and Peltola, who will have to get a lion's share of those votes to pull out ahead. The next election update comes this Friday. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
People on the Wind River Reservation say President Joe Biden's recent apology for the federal Indian boarding school system needs follow-up. The schools sought to assimilate Native children and separate them from their languages and cultures. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman has more.
In recent years, both the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribes have brought home remains of children who died at the Carlisle boarding school. The trauma of the boarding school system still impacts those communities today.
I hope they prove it. It's good for Biden to offer an apology, but that isn't enough.
I think the apology needs to go deeper than just the boarding school issue. It needs to deal with physical genocide, extermination, decimation of the buffalo.
Increase funding for tribal nations to be able to regain everything that was lost because of the boarding school policy.
That was Northern Arapaho member Cherokee Brown, former Eastern Shoshone Business Council Chairman John St. Clair, and Northern Arapaho Business Councilwoman Karen Returns to War. I'm Hannah Haberman.
Federal officials announced a new round of funding to help tribes access clean drinking water. As Alex Hager reports for the Mountain West News Bureau, that includes nearly $35 million for tribes in Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, and Wyoming.
Across the country, nearly half of all tribal homes do not have access to reliable, clean drinking water. This money, which comes from the Inflation Reduction Act, is part of a federal effort to change that. The Ute Mountain Ute tribe in Colorado and the San Carlos Apache tribe in Arizona are among those getting money to plan, build, and maintain pipelines and water treatment plants. The Biden administration says this pool of money will help it stay on track with a goal to give 40% of its climate spending to marginalized communities. This comes as tribes in the Southwest are asking for a bigger say in talks about how to use the Colorado River. They've been largely excluded from negotiations about the river since the earliest days of its management. I'm Alex Hager.
The Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma and Prime Video have teamed up to bring the Cherokee language to viewers through dub and subtitles on select titles in Prime Video's library. It's part of the tribe's efforts to preserve the Cherokee language. The first production was Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. The episode premiered during a recent special screening in Tahlequah. All season one episodes of the series are being translated and expected to be available in Cherokee by the spring of 2025. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
President-elect Donald Trump went to Washington today to meet with President Biden and Congress. Trump and Biden met for around an hour, both promising a smooth transition. Melania Trump refused the traditional meeting with outgoing First Lady Jill Biden. Trump joked about a possible, currently illegal, third term at the House Republican conference. The 22nd Amendment in the Constitution states, quote, "No person shall be elected to the office of the president more than twice," end quote. It also states that vice presidents who serve less than 2 years in the case of a presidential replacement can serve for two full terms after the fact. Representative Dan Goldman, a Democrat from New York, plans to file a resolution in the House on Thursday that would express support for the 22nd Amendment to reaffirm the already enshrined law. In order to amend the Constitution and modify the term limits for the president, both the House and Senate would need to approve amendment language by a two-thirds vote. Then it must be ratified by three-quarters or 38 of the 50 states. Trump won 34 states in this year's election. Republicans are projected to have majority control in both houses of Congress.
Just a week after the election, Trump has announced some of his planned appointments. He intends to form a Department of Government Efficiency, though it is unlikely to be a federal executive department. Official departments require congressional approval. It's more likely to be a component of the executive office of the president or a presidential commission working closely with the Office of Management and Budget. Trump plans to appoint Vivek Ramaswamy and Elon Musk as co-commissioners. Musk has been referring to the department by the acronym DOGE, a reference to both the DOGE internet meme and Dogecoin, a cryptocurrency named for the meme. Army veteran and Fox and Friends co-host Pete Hegseth will be the next Secretary of Defense. Hegseth lobbied then-President Trump to pardon former members of the U.S. Armed Forces accused or convicted of war crimes. Paul Eaton, a retired U.S. Army officer who chairs VoteVets, said yesterday that Hegseth is, quote, "wholly unqualified to head the Department of Defense and hold the lives of our troops in his hands," end quote. Trump's choice for ambassador to Israel is former Arkansas governor and presidential candidate Mike Huckabee. J Street, a liberal pro-Israel advocacy group, said Mr. Huckabee's appointment, quote, "is further proof that pro-Israel for Trump is totally disconnected from Jewish values, safety, or self-determination," end quote. Former New York Congressman Lee Zeldin, who has a history of opposing critical environmental protections and clean energy job investments, will be the new head of the Environmental Protection Agency. While in the House, Zeldin earned a score of just 14 out of 100 from the League of Conservation Voters. All presidential appointments must be approved by the Senate, which the Republican Party controls.
A new coalition called We Are California has just announced its formation. It's a group of hundreds of nonprofits seeking to reaffirm their commitments to inclusion, community and democracy, and they're organizing events across the state this weekend. Suzanne Potter reports.
This weekend, a new coalition called We Are California is holding meetings up and down the state, preparing to resist anticipated attacks from the incoming Trump administration. Hundreds of nonprofits have joined the coalition, whose mission is to promote inclusion, community, and democratic norms. Angelica Salas is with CHIRLA, the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles.
So what are we bracing for? Exactly what Donald Trump said he was going to do. Mass deportations, family separation, worksite raids. These are all things that he has done in the past. But what we're expecting is a scale of attack on our community that is unprecedented.
The coalition hopes that by banding together, they can fight any erosion of civil rights for LGBTQ plus people, immigrants, and more. The gatherings this weekend will take place online and in person in the Bay Area, Fresno, Los Angeles, Orange County, and San Diego. Find out more at wearecalifornia.org. Salas says California has also put limits on how new immigration detention centers can be built.
We can also model what it means to resist, but what it means to defy. Because I think last time we resisted, this time around, it's really about putting in place everything that interrupts this agenda.
In 2017, lawmakers passed the California Values Act, which says no state or local resources can be used to assist federal immigration enforcement and declares schools, hospitals, and courthouses as safe spaces. The California Trust Act says jails should not hold people with low-level nonviolent offenses past their initial detention period solely to give the feds time to initiate deportation proceedings. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Shareholder influence has amplified corporate climate responsibility efforts. The hope is that increased initiatives will drive meaningful emissions reductions, particularly in high-impact sectors like food production. With more on the story, it's Farah Siddiqui.
The food we consume is a significant contributor to global greenhouse gas emissions, with beef production key to the fast food industry among the leading sources. Pressure on major fast food chains to set measurable climate goals has begun to build, not only from environmental groups, but also from a somewhat unexpected source. Shareholders. This shift reflects a broader trend in shareholder activism, says Dr. Kevin Chua, a business professor at Northeastern University.
The public campaigns tend to be those that include shareholder proposals, can involve litigation. It could be as simple as writing a public letter to a company or to a group of companies asking for a demand.
He says these strategies have led companies like Jack in the Box and Wingstop to set broad climate goals, driven by nonprofits focused on environmental accountability. He notes to avoid resistance from large investors, these goals tend to stay general, allowing companies some discretion in defining their environmental commitments. In addition to fast food chains, shareholder activism extends across other industries, from agriculture to fossil fuels. The goals may be to influence corporate practices on issues like climate goals, diversity, and equity. Dr. Chua says this activism is part of a broader system where not only shareholders but also regulators and financial entities play a role in urging greater corporate responsibility.
There have been many instances of nonprofits and religious groups being quite influential. They've done it either because of persistence, because they've brought these issues back to companies over time. Another has been where they're collaborating with others, approaching the company with a larger group.
He says shareholder influence has managed to boost corporate climate responsibility efforts. Many hope that growing these efforts through private talks or public proposals will lead to real emission reductions, especially in high-impact sectors like food production. For Commonwealth News Service, I'm Farah Siddiqui.
KBOO's news poet Dan Raphael is wondering how many New Year's we'll have next year.
January 2025 is feeling like January 1st, 2000. The computers won't crash, but America might. Not Y2K, but YUK. Yuck. Maybe Trump will take over early, like January 6th. Maybe the economy will surge with people buying cars, appliances, coffee, worried about inflation to come. We may have to worry about voting again. May have to protest, fight, get jailed in order to have something worth voting for. Of course, the government that was too clotted and blocked to do anything for Biden or Obama will be high-speed Teflon. Change so fast, you might not think this is America anymore, but this is what America has become, while we've been online and locked down. People will work Uber and DoorDash for debt relief. If you're not on X, you won't get electricity, Social Security, or water you can see through. If it was winter in America in the 70s when Gil Scott Heron sang about it, soon America could be like a frozen moon of Jupiter. We might have to worry about breathing again. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 13th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael and Eliza Yurkov. The producer is Eliza Yurkov, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Alex Gonzalez, Farah Siddiqui, Eric Galatis, Kathleen Shannon, Suzanne Potter, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. Can you believe all of our KBOO programs, including This Evening News, are supported by our wonderful members? Well, if you want to become a member, a wonderful member at that, and support our programming, you can. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for news in depth.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. QDoc, Portland's queer documentary film festival, kicks off Friday, November 15th at the Hollywood Theater. For all the juicy details on this year's event, I spoke with festival co-directors Molly King and Deb Kemp. So for folks who don't know, what is QDoc?
QDoc Film Festival is a documentary film festival that is dedicated to LGBTQ plus documentaries and their makers. And it is one of the only film festivals in the world that's dedicated specifically to queer documentaries.
So you two, as the co-directors, you put this whole shebang together. What is the process like from, QDoc last year to QDoc